I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
You're listening to Down to Agribusiness with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Welcome to the Agribiz podcast. This is the first December podcast of the year, and we're nearly there for 2022. So we're kind of looking at what's happening in the world right now. There's a few policy stories. There's a few little earnings bits and pieces, a few little look aheads for next year coming up as well. But I think we'll start with one of the big policy stories of the week. Phelim, you were talking about this new regulator for the ag food industry. Can you let us know what's happening here and what the plans are?
Yes, Larkin, this is a fairly long-running saga. It has its roots back in unfair trading practices legislation that were brought forward by the European Union. The process started in 2016. They were introduced at a European level in 2018, and they became effective in Irish law, if you like, from the 20th of April this year. Now, we didn't have the domestic legislation in place to enforce that, so an interim unfair trading practices group was set up by the minister to carry forward. This will be put in a permanent footing in the new year with the appointment of an agri-food regulator, and the legislation for this was brought before the Dáil this week, so that process has now started. It was announced again, I would say, with quite a bit of political fanfare by the minister, that this is the government, if you like, along with the European Union, doing something meaningful to try and improve the trading position of farmers, the people at the end of the line, and indeed fishers as well, of course, as he highlighted. But, you know, the people at the end of the supply chain that finish up as price takers, if you like, in any environment. So the reality is, of course, it won't change the market for the produce, but the ambition, I think, of the legislation and having a regulator is in place is that he will be able to look in and see how fair is the process and all that. Now, you know, again, if we're to be sceptical here, we can say that, look, the remit is quite narrow in terms of what he can do. For example, he cannot dive in and publish what goes on beyond the farm gate, if you like, what happens in the factories. You know, there's a lack of transparency there from the time the animals are sold to the factory until the product, whether it's beef or dairy, appears again in the supermarket shelf or in a restaurant menu. But the reality is he will look to bring more information. Whether he can get anything meaningful there, it would have to be with the cooperation of the processors. That will be remain to be seen. And look, I think I've concluded this week's piece by saying it would be easy to be dismissive of this as another quango, and that it'll make very little difference in the day-to-day lives and trading of farmers. However, where there was nothing, there will now be something. And I think we should look at this perhaps as a first step of an office that might in time evolve, that could be developed. And this is where the appointments will be very important in this. You know, if they get the right dynamic person into the role, then you can see them pushing out the boundaries all the time and making the office more and more relevant to the whole supply chain debate. So I think it's a case of wait and see. It's not, as things stand today, an announcement of a solution, but I think it's perhaps the first step on a journey that can be and and bring a better trading relationship and better understanding between farmers and factories, which has, you know, let's face it, at various times over the years been a major point of conflict. So it's one, I think, too, that, you know, we should judge on results. We shouldn't prejudge it until we see it in place for a period of time.
Oh, okay, Philip, thanks for the pitch there, but allow me to be a small bit cynical here. What I understand is if I'm a farmer and I am offered, I don't know, €2 a kilo for beef, the regulator's not going to do anything about that. But if I'm offered €2 a kilo for beef and aren't paid for 6 weeks when they're supposed to be paid in 3 weeks, that's what the regulator is going to be looking at. So the regulator doesn't really care very much about the price or how the price arrived at. It just basically makes sure that you get paid within a reasonable period. Am I correct?
You picked up a perfect example there, Lorcan, just of how narrow the legislation is. And again, this is something, it hasn't been an issue with farmers, because indeed there are even factories in Ireland that would proudly boast as part of their offering, we pay on the day. So if you deliver cattle to the factory today, you will get the check home with you this evening. That hasn't been an issue. That's, if you like, a solution to a problem that doesn't exist there. But however, you know, it has been well known over time that there's been small processors where, perhaps in the vegetable sector, that have direct contracts with retailers, with supermarkets. They have been notorious in the past for being very slow payers. Contract might say 28 days. They might stretch it for an extra week or two. The legislation will be there to put an end to that. So that, again, if you're a small business operator, things like that and cash flow are very, very important. That's why not to be dismissive of it. But as you say, the price of beef on the day, it will not change with or without this regulator, Larkin. You hit the nail on the head there.
Yeah, and I suppose to get any kind of insight into why the price is the price, they need to have more insight of what's happening in the processors. And that is something that the processors have complete control over and look like will maintain complete control over. Like the regulator won't have any real say in it.
Absolutely, because most of the major meat processors in this country, they don't even publish annual accounts, you know. And again, that's something that, and we look at and we try and judge the profitability of the sector based on international experience. If you look at the major players, the global-based players, the JBSs, the Tyson Foods, et cetera, of this world, they publish quarterly updates, never mind annual financial accounts. And that allows everyone to have a look in to see how that business is doing, what type of a margin they're earning, you know, how profitable they are, et cetera. So I think that's the sort of thing that will bring real confidence to farmers and understanding of the other side of the business. But look, so far that hasn't happened. And this legislation isn't going to make that happen either.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some lobbying going on to make sure this legislation never makes it happen. Anyway, so just quickly, Anne, just like Philip said, this is a long time coming. Speaking of long time coming, I noticed you did a small piece about co-ops this week. I noticed that the legislation is from the 1800s. So can you give us, the quick synopsis of what the proposal for this co-op legislation is?
Yeah, Lorcan. I mean, this is really, I suppose, speaking with ICOS, who are the Irish Cooperative Organisation Society, this has been lobbied for decades almost by ICOS. It's really about modernising the co-op sector. And really, since we had the Companies Act in 2014, this brings the legislation for co-ops much closer to that. So there's a lot in this. It makes it easier. I suppose there's key provisions around making it easier to set up co-ops. Fewer members are required. Founding members can include corporate entities. Gives audit exemptions for smaller co-ops. And as we know, co-ops don't just exist in the agriculture sector, but in, you know, a range of community type settings across the country. And I think the purpose of the legislation is to modernise, but also to encourage, certainly in the area of social enterprise, the foundation of a lot more co-ops. It also provides for virtual and hybrid meetings that can, that was very important coming out of COVID-19. Two key areas in it, really. ICOS, I think, have broadly welcomed this and have been calling for it. They are concerned about the measures around mergers that may make it a little bit more difficult. And obviously, one of the biggest implications for existing co-ops and directors is clarity on fiduciary duties. You know, these are the actual legal duties of directors, and they will now be codified like they are in company law. So that will be a bit of a sea change, I think, for company directors. Again, ICOS say nothing that they're worried about. They welcome it. And I think it is broadly to be welcomed. It gives clarity to directors.
Yeah, it looks like a lot of, like, kind of almost housekeeping on legislation that should have been done, as you said, decades
many,
ago.
Many, many years
good,
ago.
It's good to see that's getting done. Speaking of legislation, I thought the one interesting article you had this week I thought was very interesting was the carbon capture. Like, I think it was one of the Danish that was looking to go carbon neutral by soil sequestration. And kind of the carbon story continues to be a huge kind of rolling story that we're going to be covering for years and years. But the way it affects how businesses are looking at things. So, like, do you think that we're still going to see more and more greenwashing? Are we going to see, or is these real kind of the carbon story that we're going to see, is it something that we're going to just concentrate on farmers and let the rest of the industry take care of itself?
Well, I didn't say that the Albert Heijn story was greenwashing.
I did not.
But it is
my general cynicism about all these things maybe is creeping into my language. I'm right, sorry.
But it is. I mean, but it is interesting for, like, in terms of what they're doing. They're talking about reduced emissions, lower emissions dairy, but actually this has been achieved by increasing soil carbon sequestration. So it's not actually, you know, it's not technically by reducing the emissions in the product, and that is going to be a challenge. It's going to be a net figure,
not a gross figure. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, so, and look, this is going to be a greater challenge. I mean, I'm not sure that it's going to be to the benefit over the longer term of Royal Ayrwear or the retailer that they're partnering with on this, because I just think that the tolerance for this type of thing is probably getting slimmer and slimmer. But there you have it. It is a push in that direction, and I think, I mean, if this were 5 years ago, it probably would have worked better. But I think customers and consumers, their tolerance for greenwashing is less, and it's been called out an awful lot more as well. And obviously, while the European taxonomy on sustainable investments doesn't provide for agriculture yet, it will. I mean, one of the key focuses of that legislation for businesses is to get rid of greenwashing. So I think that the walls are going to come up around this type of activity. But an interesting one anyway.
Absolutely. There was some FAO report out as well. Did I miss that, or did I mishear? There was an FAO report out about carbon sequestration and carbon intensity as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. This was the FAO's report. I think they do it annually, looking at emissions of the global agri-food system. So look, it is a really interesting read in terms of, you know, there's regional variation. I suppose one of the standouts for me, they look at a period from 2000 to 2020, and greenhouse gas emissions from agri-food systems, so the whole food chain, increased by 9% from 2020, while emissions from non-food emissions, so non-food sectors, grew by almost 50% since 2000. And I suppose when you think about the debate that we've had in this country in relation to emissions, you know, it very much puts it into perspective in terms of what has been happening in agriculture and food. But the global
that those numbers are quite stark. Is that point to, like, just agriculture? It's just very bad at getting his messages across, or is it agriculture just bad at lobbying and other people are better? Like, because if you listen to, like, watch news headlines, listen to how agriculture portrayed from an environmental perspective, it seems like agriculture is the sole source of carbon dioxide in the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, we inherently all know, but it's not necessarily the main message we're getting every day, that the greatest emitter and the greatest challenge we have in terms of rising emissions is fossil fuels and combustion for energy. So, but obviously agriculture does account for, and the agri-food system does account for about 30% of overall global emissions. And it does get a significant amount of flak because of that. And also in terms of decarbonizing, Lorcan, agriculture it's an easier win than decarbonizing fossil fuels and combustion. And we know that. We know that politically it is easier and the transition is easier if we can get farmers to do the things that we want farmers to do. And if at a policy level, we can get consumers to stop consuming as much livestock. And I think that's the general thrust of it. But the FAO report is interesting. It also tells us that the emissions intensity of food products, so of beef, the likes of beef and milk and cereals, have decreased over that period. And so ultimately it is that age old story that as production efficiency increases, carbon intensity of those products decrease. And there's regional variations in that. So the lowest carbon intensity producer. Europe is among the, and stands out as the lowest. You know, its carbon intensity of beef production is about four times lower than in Africa, which isn't surprising, but two times lower, I'd say, than in the Americas or Asia. So, you know, we're in a situation where we know that consumption is going to increase over the next decade. That's going to be met by increased production, but that increased production isn't going to come from Europe, which is effectively the producer that can produce with the lowest emissions intensity. It's just, you know, almost a ludicrous situation.
Yeah, it seems like you know, like let's go for the people that make them do the most environmental damage to increase production because that suits politically or something.
Well, we'll feel better about it. But Phelan has written about this a number of times, and that it, you know, ultimately it's not going to do very much for the global climate or atmosphere because we have only one atmosphere. So that's it in a nutshell. That's available online, Lorcan.
So basically the environmental thing to do is buy Irish beef is clearly the environmental, the mature thing to do.
Exactly.
That's good to get that message. Thanks, Dan. I suppose the other thing as well, as we do with climate, we'll have a quick look at the future as well, because there was a few earnings reports this week, and I looked at one particularly, was the Greencore earnings. And Greencore, they basically supply sandwiches to the US, sorry, the UK market. They're very kind of consumer-facing business. So it was interesting to see that they their profits almost more than doubled from 2021 to 2022. Obviously, in 2021, the COVID pandemic lockdowns were a huge factor in earnings, so they're probably not that comparable year on year. But interesting, I think, that I saw in it was that their guidance for 2023 was basically a big flag they were waving, saying we're very concerned about the consumer because inflation in the UK is quite high. They're worried what the UK economy is going to do, and they're concerned that the consumer still hasn't felt the full effect of inflation, meaning that they're worried that their product, which isn't necessarily a premium product, but it is because they're sandwiches in shops, will be affected by consumer spending, reduction in consumer spending going forward. I think it's interesting that markets investors very much picked up on that message from the earnings, because despite having a massive increase in profits, shares in the company dropped 8% the day after the results were announced. So I think it's kind of looking forward, and kind of, again, if you sign up to the Agribusiness email as well, I have a few notes about that in that today as well. And it's just like looking at what's happening next 2023. Inflation is a huge story for everybody, but we're starting to see maybe signs that inflation is rolling over. We saw that euro inflation came in at 10% in November, which is much lower than expected, and also energy inflation is rolling out of that as well. But also we have to look at how people in Ireland are kind of prepared for what's coming next. And again, there's very interesting data there as well. There was Dan O'Brien over at the IIEA put a chart on Twitter yesterday just showing the level of household deposits in Ireland. And the level of household deposits in Ireland are 150 billion euros at the moment, which is basically 30,000 euros per household in the country, which is absolutely huge amount of money to have kind of banked, I suppose. Also, we see that the debt levels are quite low as well. So if we are facing into a recession or a downturn in the Irish economy or the European economy in the next year or two, I think Ireland is, especially Ireland consumers, are very well positioned right now to weather that storm. This is not like it's going to be 2007, 2008 again, where the whole world falls apart and the financial system crashes. We could just have a slight slowdown in economic activity, people retrench a little bit, but everyone gets to it okay. I know it's me being unusually optimistic. Normally, I'm the doom and gloom merchant here, but I'm kind of being slightly looking at the numbers going, this might be so bad. If we have a downturn in Europe and Ireland next year, we're probably going to get through it fairly okay. Anyone else have anything interesting, Phelan, Moran? Have I missed anything exciting this week, or can we wrap up there?
I think, Lorcan, we've touched on both points there, or on most points of interest this week. I think in terms of what's going to be coming down the track at us over the next week or two, we'll be looking a bit more at who has done what this year in terms of where the big trade movements have been globally. And I think the one to really keep an eye on is China, because they're getting into serious difficulties now, again, with COVID and their lockdown policy. That's proved very controversial at the political level, but it's also causing great concern in the international agri-food trading industry. So that's one I think that we'll be keeping an eye on next week and the weeks ahead.
Yeah, we did a small piece about China in this week's paper, but it's just kind of looking at the protests and how much they have upset the global economy. In 3 or 4 days, we saw all markets sell off. And then when the protests seemed to ease off, the last couple of days, everything turned around again. So it really is China is a huge story, I think, for everybody in the world. But as you say, particularly for food exporters, because China is a massive consumer. So of agricultural products, and it's a market that I'm sure Irish beef people are very interested in, as you've written several times already this year, Phelim.
Absolutely.
I think we'll leave it there, Phelim, and thank you very much. Join us next week for another AgBiz podcast. Don't forget to sign up for the AgBiz newsletter from the Irish Farmers Journal, and we'll talk to you all next week.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.